series Overlooking the River at Harbor Park in Middletown every Tuesday at 7 p.m. through September 1st. The rain location is south.
Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for women over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. You're listening to WESU Middletown. I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of For Women Over 40. I'm so glad you could join us. Today I'll be talking with two women who have experienced what is called the empty nest syndrome, the ins, outs, and solutions to coping with children leaving home. As writers, we'll also hear some of their thoughts and feelings in their own poignant and written words. Lydia Chiappetti is mom to a 24 and 26-year-old son and daughter and lives with her husband of 33 years. She's enjoyed a diversity of professions and volunteer positions, cataloger at Christie's Auction House, campaign assistant for state gubernatorial race and parent association president. She is a four-year member of East Hill Writers Workshop. Her passions include her local French book group, yoga, and traveling. Lori Pelican-Strobel, forever 49, and the problem is she won't tell me how much forever, plus, lives with her husband of over 29 years. She is also a mother to two adult daughters, ages 22 and 25, and a dog named Louie. She's a member of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. Lori's work experience has ranged from pharmaceutical sales representative, Pilates instructor, community college teacher, to real estate agent. Lori and Louie like to devote their time as a registered therapy animal team. Her favorite job has been and will always be mom. You can currently find Lori walking her dog, Louie, blogging at Book Body and Soul. Book Body Soul, my apologies, are working hard on her upcoming book based on Louie. So welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So before we start talking, I just wanted to say that the exact origin of the term empty nest is really unclear. It seems to have surfaced in the 70s, and in doing my own research, it sounded as if it was both a colloquialism and also had something to do with birds flying away from the nest. But we know now that there's a direct correlation between parents' involvement in their children's lives and their sense of disequilibrium when they leave. The article's reference that empty nest syndrome refers to feelings of depression, sadness, and grief. This may occur when children go to college or get married. Women are more likely than men to be affected. And when the nest is emptying, mothers are usually going through other significant life events as well, such as menopause or caring for their elderly parents. Because more mothers work these days and therefore feel less emptiness when their children leave home, there's also an increasing number of adult children between 25 and 34 living with their parents at home. So in trying to find a term for this, the Mayo Clinic says that empty nest syndrome isn't a clinical diagnosis but a phenomenon. And in truth, I think, as I was thinking about this on the way here, it's really a phenomenon of the 21st century, because in all reality, in previous generations and previous eras, children did leave, or children did stay, or children did stay the long haul in one home of multiple generations. But it seemed not to be such an issue as it is now. It seems to have evolved into, you know, something for which there are all these self-help groups and therapists who have now sprung into action in response to what seems to be a real need. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think that during my grandmother's time period, it was just expected when she met her husband, she would move out, move to his family, and that was just the normal course of life. And then when my mom had us and we left for college, she had a really difficult time, you know, very, very upset, panic attacks, crying for weeks on end. And I think it is this century that it's happening to.
Lydia?
I would say parenting now has become almost like a career. It really is a career. And there's a term that is used, precision parenting. And so when we, as parents, we had our children a little bit later. I was in my 30s. Many of the women I've talked to have been in their 40s. And they tackled it as a career so that they went into it in such a way that they made a huge commitment. And when that commitment ended, or partially ended when their children went off to college or they went off to their jobs eventually, they really were out of a job. And it was almost like they had to go part-time or they were fired. So I think this has led to much of what we've seen in this empty nest syndrome that we're talking about. Yes, it's not a clinical diagnosis per se, but we are feeling a type of postpartum depression as we felt after having the baby, the same type of thing.
So let me just introduce both of you by way of just asking, can you just share a little bit of your story? Lydia, why don't you start?
Well, I was going to tell my story from the beginning. It was the college drop-off. I didn't have time to really feel the effects of anything, so I was so busy running around, doing the Bed Bath & Beyond, pick up the packing, the schlepping. And so we got to the colleges, and of course I had two children going off, and each was a different experience, but I'll address the first. We had the parent talk as we got to the last moment of school. The dean takes you in as parents, and they tell you, it is your time to go. Let the children figure it out. Say quick goodbyes to your children and leave. And that was when it really hit me, because we'd been so busy chasing our tails up to that point that suddenly we're just driving away, and you didn't really have quite time to prepare. I now know ways I could have prepared better, but that's after the fact. So you arrive home, you pass the empty bedroom, and you're hit with the emptiness, the sadness, and you go into a funk. And the funk is, what now? What next? After all that preparation and all of that getting ready for school, you're just left with nothing. And just a quick little aside, a little footnote, I did see a friend of mine crying at the first rest stop as we left school, which made me feel better. She was crying her eyes out, and it was someone whose child we knew from high school. My son and her son had gone to the same college, and we sort of commiserated right there. At least I wasn't the only one feeling this. That was the immediate effect. There were many effects of this that happened as the months rolled on, which I can address.
Lori, want to tell me a little bit about your journey?
Sure. The first time that my oldest daughter went to college, I do recall the same, you know, running around getting ready for college and packing the car, and we drive her there and get her room all ready. It's all of so much excitement. And my younger daughter was with us at the time, and she was in high school. And I found that she was a little off, my younger daughter. She wasn't herself. And the older daughter, we finally say goodbye to her. She's going off to a picnic. I could tell her emotions were getting the best of her, and she just asked us to walk away. We walked away, we get into the car, and we're driving, and I'm just silent, and my younger daughter starts sobbing, uncontrollably sobbing. So I knew at that point in time I could not cry, because I had to take care of her and her emotions. And she just got home and moved into her sister's room, moved her laptop in, moved her clothes in, laid in the bed for 2 days, and finally emerged saying, look at all the clothes that my sister left. I can now borrow her clothes. And we were all then good. We knew it was fine.
What do you call empty nest syndrome for a sibling?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's maybe the empty nest family phenomena.
Yeah, it is.
They don't like being the focal point either once their sibling is gone. They know all of the emphasis is going to be on them. So that's another side effect.
Absolutely. I agree with that. She was a little worried.
Absolutely. So, Lydia, what were some of the things that made the transition easier?
Well, with my first, I was busy now with the second child. I was Parent Association still president at the school, getting involved in the same types of activities I was involved in before. I added more in. That kept me from focusing too much on the loss of the first child. But with the second one, definitely it was much more of an impact. And I missed that routine of my life. And the interesting thing is my life evolved around the school because I was so active there. And with that gone, I wasn't even seeing the same people that I saw on a daily basis. and I didn't have the same activities or jobs. So I was questioning, who am I other than a mother? And I really needed to do some soul searching. And I did become involved in what I'd always wanted to do. I wanted to write, but that didn't happen overnight. You have to go through that whole grieving process before you can even get to what is going to fill that void.
I think this is a good time for you to read one or two paragraphs, if you would, by your of your work,
okay.
The Leaving. This is Lydia giving us two paragraphs or so of her essay on this very subject.
I am going to preface it by saying The Leaving is not the college leaving. This is the second leaving after the boomerang child has been home for 8 months. And these are the feelings that I have about that second leaving, which are different than the first leaving. I had only thought about the exhilaration of her finding a job and finally moving out, not the absence. Of course she'll be back often and for long weekends. It'll be just the same as always. I tried to console her unconvincingly. No, it'll never be the same again. I'm really finally moving on to the next stage, Caroline sighed. She looked the part of the young professional as she modeled her new tweed suit trousers and button-down blouse, topped by the never-worn 21st birthday present at her neck, a strand of softly colored pearls. Having seen her for the last 5 years in mostly jeans, corduroys, and puffy vests, it was a treat to see the corporate persona. Her long blonde hair was in need of cutting and styling to fit in with this new lifestyle. And I wondered if her all-American face with those innocent big round eyes would become hardened and savvy-looking after a few years in the corporate world. Would she bail out after a year or stick it out for the experience and money? I didn't want to broach these thoughts about her returning home to regroup and start the job search again. It was a stretch for me to feel as nostalgic as she, since we had waited for her to arrive at this juncture for 8 long months.
Lori, why don't you read a little bit from your essay, Mom on Demand? Lori's essay is in the anthology, The Zen of Midlife Mothering, and why don't you give us one or two paragraphs that resonate with you?
Sure. I'm standing at my new desk, a desk that can be raised to a standing height or lowered to a sitting height. I love it. The room that this desk stands in is my office. It has been in a bit of transformation lately, just like my life. The walls are painted the softest of green. A small but dazzling crystal chandelier light hangs from the center of the room. It is pleasant here, alone with my own thoughts. Suddenly, I hear the garage door open and footsteps. Mom, I'm home, yells my daughter from the kitchen as she loudly drops her book bag, coat, and whatnot that I envision lying in a tray on the floor. My peacefulness is broken by her voice, and I'm suddenly transported back 10 years ago, when she would come home from school with the same declaration. Although times have changed, things have a way of staying the same. I am still here, whether or not she is. Finally, I hear, Mom, as she nears my office, and upon finding me, it is like presto. I am on. Just like the cable TV that always slightly glows as it waits to be powered on, she has turned on the Mom on Demand remote. Press the button, I'm available 24 hours a day. My children choose when, how, and where to connect with me. I am always here glowing, softly waiting, whether or not I am needed. Nobody brings my children what they need more than Mom on Demand.
I love your words, both your words and both your thoughts. We're talking today with two empty nesters and moms, writers Lydia Chiappetti and Lori Pelican-Strobel, about the phenomenon of empty nest syndrome, how they coped with it, how they reacted to it, and how their lives have changed as a result of it. So I'm wondering, Lori, what made the transition easier in the long run, and did your feelings change and morph into something else?
I think with the first child, I was still busy with the second child at home, and that kind of kept my mind off of the fact that we were missing someone from our family, even though at the dinner table it was evidently glaring us in the face having an empty seat. When the second child went off to college, they were both now gone, and my husband and I, we just turned and looked at each other and said, what are we going to do? Our whole social life really evolved around our children with their sports activities and extracurricular activities. And now you know, as Lydia said, we weren't seeing these same people. We had to call them up instead of seeing them at a sporting event. And we found that we really kind of needed to regroup ourselves and look forward to doing stuff alone, which was kind of terrifying at sometimes.
Lydia?
Oh, I agree totally with everything Lori just said. Everything shifted. And I'd heard an expression that Teutonic plates shift in a marriage during that transition. It was really frightening. And I feel like the only thing my husband would say to me at dinner would be, did you hear from the kids today? And my line was, no news is good news, because I wanted to hear as much as he did, but I didn't want that to be the emphasis. And it's taken a while for us to get those common activities going. It wasn't overnight. Like, now we do yoga together. We do some entertaining, theater, museums, travel, and we've gotten into a rhythm. But there's still, did you hear from the kids today, refrain that's echoing at dinner. But now I don't feel so guilty about talking about them because we've got other things.
It's a very hard balance. Excuse me. Do you think it would be fair to say that this is a perfect place for many middle-aged women to reassess their marriage as well as their lives? And in addition, really reassess their own mortality?
Oh, absolutely. And I think starting a little bit earlier than the children leaving is necessary, but we don't know to do that. And that is some advice I could give, is to start thinking about the reassessment. And it's a huge fact that divorce has been on the increase. After 50 years old, the rate has doubled between 1990 and 2009. And that figure alone should make women think about what direction they want to move in terms of their marriage, their careers, their life after their children. One in four ended in divorce. I mean, that's a scary statistic.
I've heard the same thing. I think they call it the graying divorce. And I think preparing ahead of time, knowing that your children are going to go off, and you do now have this time to regroup as a couple. My husband and I, we ended up getting a dog. So, and that really kind of brought us back together, and looking at him as kind of like the new child in the family. And people thought we were absolutely insane because now we had all this time that we could go travel. But we felt we wanted a dog. We never had one before. And so now we were able to devote time to this dog. He's become so much part of our life. And now our kids come back because they want to see the dog.
At this point, would you say that the assessment of your own marriage takes time to work out, or did either of you, by the way, look for counsel, consider going into therapy, either because of your own sense of transition or the transition in your family life?
I personally didn't. I just felt we were just moving forward. You know, we were able to keep busy. We had the new addition in our family with the dog. We got to see friends that we hadn't seen in a long time. We got married young, and we had children a little bit younger than some of our other friends. So now they were kind of stuck home with their kids, and we were able to go visit them, which was a nice surprise for us. But I didn't think we felt that there was any intervention that we needed. We just knew that we had this kind of void that we were learning to fill, that our children weren't around anymore. But we did always say, hey, you know, what are the kids doing? Have you heard from them? Just like Lydia said, that was always a constant.
Lydia, did you do any therapy or reach out for support groups or need any help with regard to the changing configuration of your family?
We probably could have used some support group or therapy, but we actually just didn't make time for it. During the last 10 years, my husband was working in New York, New Jersey, out of state. So he was traveling. He was down there on the weekends. On the weekdays, traveling home on the weekends. And with my children gone, I felt the compulsion that I needed to go and spend time with him where he was. So I was traveling in and out of state, trying to meet him where he was, which was stressful for me, but he needed that at that time. We didn't know how to be together as a couple 7 days a week. That's something we had to relearn. He has since moved back home, and we are actually reacclimating to his being around, the children being gone, but him being here. I was used to just being myself with my children. So we've had a whole interesting shift. And I think we have finally worked through it, but it's taken about 3 years. And we'll probably go through some more shifts, but that's been the biggest hurdle for us, was the distance.
So, Laurie, I'm wondering how many years would you say your transition has been? Just to give the listeners some information. 3 years, less than that?
I think it's it kind of evolves. It's had a, kind of a tide. As one goes, you feel some loss, then the next one goes, and then the one comes back, and you're all okay, and now that one has moved out. So I think it's a process. I don't think you can really – it could be different for every person if they have one child or if they have four children. I think it may vary for each person. For me personally, it's probably taken a couple of months to get used to each situation as it's changed. And with my oldest daughter now just moving out last week, she bought her own new home. I think it's going to take me a couple months now to understand that she's in her new place. She's moving forward with her life, and I have a new chapter now to help her in her new home.
Along with the complications that I think empty nest syndrome brings, that would make a presumption that the women who are going through it were more traditional moms. They had children in their 20s or early 30s. Now they're in their late 40s and 50s. This would be simpatico with their going through menopause. But now in the 21st century, we're talking about midlife mothers, people who are having children in their 40s and in their 50s, mothers and fathers who have blended step families, who now have 10 to maybe 15 years between generations. So I think that the complexity of this issue is probably going to become even more complex as the years move on. Would either of you agree?
Oh, I would agree, Sima. I myself, my children were just leaving when my parents needed me. And I kept thinking, what if my children were younger? How would I coping with this? I was fortunate that I had the freedom to be able to really do the hands-on care for my parents. But as all of this coincides, as parents become older and older, it's going to clash even more. So I think you're right in saying you're going to have all these multi-generations to deal with under one roof. I think the career women have the problem that they've been juggling, trying to get as much time with their children and their jobs. I think they're feeling it as poignantly as the traditional mom from the ones I've spoken to, because they are no longer doing that juggling. So it's really, they're at a loss too, because they've been working so hard at that during their career years.
And do either or both of you think that the advent of texting, email, Instagram would make this transition easier or harder? Because I remember, and I'm sure all of us would agree, you go to college and you call your parents. I mean, that was the extent to how you reached out to them or you sent them a letter. These are no longer simple times.
I think having this new technology is fabulous for the children and for us. I say embrace it, learn it, find the best way to communicate with your child. If it's texting that they like, text. If it's FaceTiming, then learn how to FaceTime. I think having this technology for all of us is really a blessing. I mean, I remember waiting for the phone call every Sunday night from my parents, and you never really talked to them other than that. But knowing that you're there, and I think having that comfort for your children that they can reach out at you at any moment is comforting, at least to me. If they needed me, I know that they would reach out to me. And on the flip side, I think as kind of a forewarning for empty nesters to be, I think you shouldn't really reach out initially in the very beginning. Let your child reach out. I think that we have a tendency to want to overhover them when they first leave. And I think it they need to kind of relax that a little bit, because I know I wanted to immediately call her an hour after we left.
Lydia?
I agree with what Laurie was saying totally. I think it is a wonderful relief to be able to know what they're doing, seeing those photos on Facebook as much as they allow you to see, seeing them looking happy. You're not going to see anybody looking unhappy on Facebook. At the same time, it's a curse in a way, because the texting, I think, has run amok amongst daughters in particular. Taking mine, for example, and many people I know, because this term has been coined by a few of us, the walking buddy. It means that your daughter is going to call you or text you as she walks from one side of the campus to the other. They want to be busy doing something while they're walking, and it gives them a safety blanket. And it's also now happened that she's lived in Brooklyn, and it's late at night, and she wants to talk to me while she's getting back home or getting to the subway. So you're kind of the lifeline, and you're hanging on this phone, and you're busy doing something, but they're saying to you, but I haven't gotten to my destination yet. And I'm thinking, well, I'm at mine. So it's an odd balance. We don't want to be too accessible. That's the problem. And they know that we're always there. And one other thing on this for advice to parents is that when your children do call, and they call frequently, they want to just get it off their chest. They want to kvetch. They don't necessarily want your advice. They want to listen. They want to hear sympathy. They don't necessarily want to fix. And that's what I have to tell my husband. Men want to give a quick fix, and that's not what they're looking for. It's a whole line of questioning, Socratic questioning, that we need to learn, not to tell them what to do or why are you walking late at night. The question would be, do you think it's a wise idea to be doing this so late at night, walking to the subway at 2 a.m.? You should be with another friend. So it's that learned questioning that I've had to find out about so that they don't get angry at me and I don't get another call, which I might not want anyway. So,
Lori?
Well, I do agree that they do call you as they're walking to classes. I've gotten that a lot. And you can't really hear them sometimes because the wind is whipping in and you're trying to have this conversation that you've been looking forward to. But they are using it as a means to get from one end of the campus to the other. I personally don't mind when they call me in the evening when they're walking back from the library. It makes me feel better that they've actually kind of thought at some point they should have a contact with somebody if something happens. Though I'm like, what am I supposed to be doing? I'd be dialing 911 on the other phone. But I do like the fact that they do reach out to me and call when they feel like they're walking. Or even now my older one, when she's driving back from work, it's becoming common practice when she's driving back from work. At night, she calls me, and we have a nice conversation about her day. She kind of lets off steam about her job, or whatever issue it is.
There's a wonderful book, Refeathering the Empty Nest, by Greenwich psychotherapist Wendy Aronson, and she really explores this topic from every potential angle. And she makes some basic premises about 21st century parents growing used to a tighter connection with their children than of earlier generations. And again, referencing what I said a few minutes ago, that for the baby boomers, it was usually a Sunday night phone call to your parents and not much more. But her flip side of this is that all of the ways that you did check in on your children, fathers having golfing events, mothers going shopping with their children, those were also times when parents could learn a lot about what their children were up to without prying. Now you're stuck on the other side of a phone or on the other side of a text or on the other side of a computer. And I think this is a really delicate balance in trying to not only stay connected, but make sure you're ensuring their safety. Would you agree with me?
Yes, it's a huge responsibility. It's almost like TMI, too much information. Our parents were in the dark. Like what they didn't know didn't hurt them. And now we're connected. We're connected in cyberspace. We can almost hear their footsteps, and you're imagining who's going to jump out of the doorway to mug them. So it is. It's extra angst. You know, we really haven't released them into the world. Because we're on the other end of that lifeline, in a way.
Yeah, I agree. I know I text my daughter, or I usually ask for a text on Monday. I want to know if she made it through the weekend safely. And I just kind of text hello with a question mark, and she'll be hi, and I know she's fine. Nothing's happened to her over the weekend. And that's a little bit of my fault. Like, I should release that and should know that she is going to be fine.
But that's not unusual, Lori. I think we've all become that way. We're all checking on them, where our parents had no idea for weeks on end.
No, they didn't. They really didn't. If they didn't hear from us on Sunday, then they would worry. That was it.
Right.
We've been talking with empty nesters and moms, Lydia Chiappetti and Lori Pelican-Strobel, about the complex intricacies of empty nest syndrome. Both of these wonderful women have experienced this by two children leaving home, coming back, leaving home. So, Lori, what would you like to leave our listeners with today? What few thoughts would you like to share?
I think that there are a couple ways that as parents we can prepare to be an empty nester. And we talked about a couple of them, and one of them, you know, is embracing the technology that's in front of us to really keep busy immediately, whether that's going out to dinner, throwing a party, redefining what your family means now with that one person gone, doing something different. I think it's also important to maybe find an old or a new hobby for yourself that you may have put down and you want to pick up again, or read more books, or learn yoga. Also really learn to kind of relish the extra space that you have in your house, and at some point you realize that, wow, my house can stay clean. It's not going to change when I come back in the afternoon. And learn to kind of find those happy points in coping with your children leaving and leaving the nest.
I think having your house look the way you'd like it to when you come home is worth its weight in gold, no?
Yes.
Lydia, your final words, please, your thoughts?
I just would like to say that we're not alone in this. 25 million parents are going through empty nest syndrome at the same time, and that was in 2013, so you know the numbers grow now. And I think we need to reach out to our friends and our different friend groups and talk about our feelings, and I do that with all of my different groups, and it does validate my feelings and gives me comfort. And I just would love to read just a couple quick lines from After the Children Have Grown by Madeline Levine. She's a clinician and consultant and an author, and she wrote Teach Your Children Well, and I just thought this sums everything up. The fact is that women are less depressed, less anxious, and less suicidal in their 50s and 60s than at any other time. There is clearly something salutary about navigating through motherhood and back into a more independent life. We don't really lose ourselves. In fact, we can become better, certainly wiser, versions of the women we've been.
Thank you. Any other thoughts for the listener?
Treasure every moment with your kids, yes. No matter what it is, whatever they give you.
Well said.
We've been talking today with empty nesters and moms Lydia Chiappetti and Lori Pelligan-Strobel. You can find Lori at bookbodysoul.com. Her essay, Mom on Demand, appeared in the anthology, The Zen of Midlife Mothering. Lydia is a regular contributor to the blog site, motheringinthemiddle.com. I really want to thank both of you for sharing your thoughts today. I think you not only have brought some hope and some support, but some comfort to women out there who ultimately may feel very alone in this journey, but really there are 25 million other women sitting right close to them that they may not be aware of. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Please stay tuned. We'll be listening to the words of Greenwich psychotherapist Wendy Aronson. Again, her book is Refeathering the Empty Nest. She'll share some thoughts with us, and hopefully by the end of this hour, we will have put some of your questions, concerns, and problems, we'll put them down for you. We're back today, and we're talking with Greenwich psychotherapist Wendy Aronson. She's written a book, Refeathering the Empty Nest, and I'm so proud and happy to have you as my guest.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be a guest.
So, as you heard, we already spoke with two mothers who are grappling mightily with empty nest syndrome, which seems like it is increasing by the day. And I'm wondering, first of all, your take on this syndrome, if you will, and a few thoughts about your interest in writing about it and authoring this book.
Okay, well, let's first talk about the issue of syndrome, which I actually address in the book, and feel that in the book I did quite a bit of research about this. The Mayo Clinic believes that this is not a syndrome. In actuality, I see it as a stage. And I think, you know, feelings can get stirred up, old feelings, feelings of, you know, loss and sadness and all of those things, a myriad of different feelings, and that can get in the way and contribute to one's functioning when during this stage of life. But that being said, people experience the emptiness, which I hate to call it empty. I actually like to call it evolving. Because I do believe that we do evolve in the nest, and as do our children out of the nest. So there are many, many stages that I delineate in my book, and there are feelings and all sorts of ways that people deal with this time of their life. What got me thinking about writing the book, I think that was your first question.
Yes.
Was I've been practicing for close to 30 years and have been dealing with many issues, and one of the most prevalent issues that really was not discussed and given too much of a highlight was this time in people's lives. And so many of my patients talked about their struggles with it and also their enjoyment with it. So, you know, there were a whole range of feelings and experiences with the people that I speak to in my office. And then I think about my own experience with my own children, and I started writing thoughts and feelings when my first one left and then when my second child left, and knew that it would be a very poignant time in my life so that I could contribute both from a personal as well as a professional perspective.
I think what's interesting to me is that children have always left home.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it historically, I don't see that it was so much of an issue as it is today. So I'm wondering, what are some of the causes mm-hmm. for this? And what are some of the remedies, if you will?
That's a really good question. Yes, children have always left the nest. And historically, they haven't gone far from the nest, if you think about it. You know, extended families live together, they live next door. So historically, it probably wasn't felt the same way. But I think we feel it so much more profoundly today because we are so much more involved parents, and we're involved in every step of the way, from getting pregnant, trying to get pregnant, or adopting, or, you know, that whole process, which in itself is very, very different than, you know, World War II generation families, to, you know, getting into nursery school and high school and college, and parents are just so much more involved. And in the book, I talk about the helicopter parent versus what I call the precision parent. And the precision parent is a style of parenting that involves proactivity and helping a child with providing tools to assist in their development. And this is very, very different than past generations. Past generations were kind of much more hands-off, if you would, and less involved. So that the involvement, which is for working parents and non-working parents, is so felt, you know, the loss of their involvement in their children's lives are really felt very profoundly.
So I'm sure that we're addressing this to many baby boomers who will be listening today. And I can attest to being one of those children who my only means of communicating with my parents was that maybe Sunday night phone call or midweek phone call, and then a couple of letters, which usually dwindled off. But now we're talking about an era of Instagram and Pinterest and iPhones and texting. And how does that come into play?
That really is another really good question. And I do remember also exactly the same Sunday night phone calls, collect phone calls, mind you.
Yes.
anyway, and so the interaction was much less, and therefore the sense of independence and autonomy was much more. Today, every step of the way is either, you know, parents are texting their children, we're talking about the college-age children or children who have left home, or vice versa, the children are checking in with their parents, and the connection is so much stronger, and the temptation for parents to be so connected is there. And it's something, you know, instead of going on a food diet, I often suggest to parents to go on a word diet. So try to be mindful. Try to take your cues from your young adult. If they're calling you all the time, certainly respond. But if they're not calling you, take their cues. They are saying to you, I'm separating. I'm kind of figuring these things out. let them be the one who's guiding this, and you be the one who is listening and responding and almost being Socratical, if you will. That's very, very helpful in allowing them to separate, and also for you as the parent to separate and to begin to develop your own rhythm and your own life.
I'm again going to reference your comment about helicopter parenting, because if we go back a generation or two, again, when children left home, it was a natural transition. And here you're speaking about mostly women, I'm sure, struggling with being alone and letting go of their children. And I'm wondering what some of those factors would be that is creating that sense of so much over-involvement.
In my book, I do quite a bit of interviewing and a number of surveys. And I think, again, it goes back to people are older when they start having children. They're giving up careers, and they're switching careers from career X to being a parent. And that parent is their new career. And they are spending 20-some-odd years refining, developing, being, you know, so precise in that career, and all of a sudden they get a new job description that says, well, we don't really need you so much, and, you know, you can take some time off and step back and do your own thing. Well, that's all great in concept, but it is a process, and that process is letting go and, again, going back to fulfilling your goals and things that are important to you. I often tell my parents that, you know, life is like a patchwork pillow, and if your family is in the big patch in the middle, then it's important at this stage to provide other patches, to provide other things in your life that provide you gratification and the ability to stretch and the ability to move into the next phase of your life. And you say that mostly this is women. I hear a lot of this from men as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was one person I interviewed who said they had a Sunday golf game with their son for, you know, 15 years, and all of a sudden, you know, the son didn't want to play golf with them anymore. And the loss that this man, this father, felt was enormous. This was their way of bonding and connecting and something they shared. So even fathers do feel this very keenly.
Hmm. What are some of the ways that people can wean themselves away from their children? What are some specific tips?
If you're talking about, again, the young adult going off to college, first and foremost is taking your cues from them in terms of connection, meaning telephone, email, text, Instagram, whatever it is, any of those ways of communicating. Take your cues from them. And also try to listen. You have to listen in a different way. Where we're used to, our knee-jerk reaction is trying to fix things and do things and provide for them. It's okay to be their parent, but it's also very, very helpful to let them know that you're listening and that they, too, can help figure this out. So really allowing them the space to, you know, make mistakes. I mean, not life and death mistakes, obviously, but to make mistakes and to allow them to come to learn from those mistakes. There was a book many, many years ago that I'm sure many of your listeners have read, The Blessing of the Skinned Knee. And The Blessing of the Skinned Knee is, you know, exactly what it sounds like. Falling, learning from falling often teaches us the most, rather than holding on to one's hand, doesn't teach us much of anything.
And what can the parents do for themselves? What are some tips you can offer them for just starting a healing process? I'm guessing that's really what it involves, an exploration and healing process. What are some of those ways?
I think of this as understanding a grieving process. And the grieving process, one is being accepting of the feelings that you have. First and foremost, you can be upset, you can be even angry that your children, after all this hard work that you've done and, you know, oh, what I've done for you, you know, they're off having a great time and starting their life, and yours is at a different phase. So being very, very accepting of the roller coaster of your feelings. And one can also be very excited. I had, you know, a couple that I was seeing in couples therapy that was thrilled, and they were very hands-on parents, but they were thrilled because with the crisis came opportunity of doing things that they had always wanted to do since before having children. They started, you know, a choir and dance lessons, and I mean, there's so many things. So I try to have a bucket list and make the bucket list something from the really logical and easy to outlandish as traveling the world or whatever. I mean, that's quite far-fetched, but you know, the bucket list can be whatever you want it to be. And if you have a spouse, it's something you and your spouse can have a spousal bucket list of things that you want to do together, whether it's take up tennis or bridge or whatever it is. So accepting your feelings, having a bucket list, knowing that things are changing and that they are evolving and that right now things are a little bit uncertain, or not even a little bit, they're very uncertain. And things are shifting.
I think it's no coincidence that this must hit mostly women harder, given that the majority of them are somewhat in mid-age and either in perimenopause or in menopause and are probably already grappling with their own bodily changes, mm-hmm. emotional states.
Sure.
I would guess also that this would be tough for some couples who have avoided their own connection and now are faced with themselves. So I wonder if you can address both women being at this pivotal stage and also women being in partnership in this pivotal stage.
That is also a very good question and something that I discuss also in the book. You know, we spend so much time with our children, and I use the analogy of having our marriages oftentimes in the back seat, and now it's time to have to put your marriage in the front seat. And this is a pivotal time because sometimes it being in the back seat for so long creates such tension and irreparable space between the couple that the rise of divorce and separation is quite high. There was an article in the New York Times called The Gray Divorce, and it talked about that this time is a time where people really reevaluate, is this what I want in my life, our life? Is this what we want in a marriage? And because we are living so much longer, there's still many chapters, hopefully, for all of us to go. So people are really reevaluating in a way that in past generations they didn't. In terms of women and, you know, what's going on for their bodies and their moods and their hormones, it's enormous because it certainly can magnify the feelings of loss, because not only are we physically losing our children, we're also physically losing the ability to have children, to have those options. And that in itself is an enormous loss for many women. Bodily changes for both men and women do occur during this midlife. And it does impact both of them, much more obviously women because of menopause. But there is also a male menopause, and that impacts libido, impacts energy and wherewithal on both men and women. So there are a lot of moving pieces, a lot of moving parts. And then there, conversely, there is the couple who says, okay, our marriage has been put on the back seat. We're going to put it in the front seat. And sometimes people go into therapy and, you know, look at ways they can strengthen their marriage and work on areas that needed working on that were perhaps put on the shelf. And sometimes other couples see this as an opportunity to really redevelop and reconnect with one another. So there are all different ranges of reactions and responses during this time.
And what other modalities might you suggest for people at this point? I'm thinking of yoga, exercise. Do you intersperse your therapies with those suggestions?
In my book, yes. In my work with people, it's very individual, and it really depends on why they come to me and the issues that they bring to the table. I always think exercise, and if people have faith and they practice their faith, it's something I certainly encourage if that's part of who they are and what they bring to the table. I think yoga is a wonderful sense of the mindfulness is so useful in really all of our lives. And exercise is such a great way to deal with depression and angst and anxiety and stress that, you know, all of those things are important. There are also support groups, community support groups. There are blogs out there. There's books to read. So there are many different ways to address one's struggles. It doesn't always have to be therapy or psychotherapy or it's not a one-size-fits-all.
Mm-hmm. I'd be remiss if I didn't discuss on a back end, what about those children who end up coming home after college and perhaps leaving and maybe coming back one more time? Empty nest syndrome isn't just when your child goes to college. There can be multiple future stages where you take them back in, you bring them back out. And I'm wondering, what do you say to parents who are grappling with children who are lost, if you will, can't find their way, can't secure a job, and then they come home and then maybe they leave again?
Well, that's a very common occurrence today, and it's often called the boomerang child. And these young adults sometimes come because there aren't, you know, the competition for jobs are enormous and not nearly as easy to come by as it was, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And the cost of living is so high that oftentimes they do come back. And then there are children or young adults, they're not children anymore, who come back because they are, to use your words, lost, can't find their way. And those children also come back. So in both of those cases, there are different scenarios. The most important thing is to set up limits and boundaries. Your home is not a dorm, and it's not their apartment. Oftentimes, helping them be part of the house and the responsibilities of the house is really important because you want to continue to foster their independence. And if you're reverting back to days gone by where, you know, breakfast was on the table, lunch, dinner, whatever, you know, mom get this, dad get this, et cetera, you're really going backwards rather than forwards. So setting up limits and expectations, you know, I have one parent who in my book that I talked to said they were so annoyed when their child came back because the house was so orderly and all of a sudden it was like, you know, a hurricane hit it and everything was all messed up and the room that they used now for crafts was then given back to the child. So that their own territory has, you know, the parents who have come up with a new rhythm and a new way of living, all of a sudden they too have to adjust. So it's twofold. Parents have to adjust. They also have to help their children adjust to the change in their nest, hence the word evolving nest, and really communicate and talk about what the mutual expectations are. The young adult who is struggling with their adulthood, finding themselves, sometimes it requires speaking to a mental health professional to find out what's going on. Is there depression? Is there, you know, something going on that, you know, they've what happened at school, you know, there could be many, many reasons why they have not found themselves or struggling. And it's really hard to do a broad stroke as to what to do in that scenario.
Sure.
It is important to keep your ears and eyes open that if they're really struggling, to really try to get help or run it by a professional or run it by a clergyman and see whether what you're seeing is typical. I don't want to say normal because I don't believe in it, but certainly typical within the range of typical responses versus perhaps some red flags that really need to be addressed.
Sure. And what one tip would you like to leave the listeners with today?
To know that the nest is not empty. It's evolving. And unlike birds, when they let their young go and they fly off, the birds go off and have a new nest. Well, we are not like birds. We have our nest. It's still there. It's not empty. It's just changing.
We've been speaking today with Greenwich psychotherapist Wendy Aronson about the topic of empty nest syndrome. Her book is called Refeathering the Empty Nest and can be found on Amazon and I'm guessing a variety of different sites.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you to the listener. This is WESU-FM 88.1 on your dial. And until next time, I'm Sima Shapiro for Women Over 40. I hope you take care.